From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. There has been a great tortilla upset, and I hope it doesn't upset you too much. We're now in the final throes of Gustavo and KCRW's Great Tortilla Tournament of Champions, and I, along with my co-judges, LA Times journalist Gustavo Arellano, KCRW's Connie Alvarez, and Eater LA's Mona Holmes, have determined which two corn tortillas and which two flour tortillas will compete in the grand finale tomorrow at Smorgasburg. We started with 64 tortillas, but now it's down to the Fuerte Four. Brace yourselves. Gustavo's here now to help me break some exciting and maybe shocking updates. Hi, Gustavo.
Hola, Evan.
All right. So I just have to say that this year has been particularly difficult. And I like to think that just like with the pie contest, where I really believe that our competition here at KCRW upped the pie game in Southern California, I really think that this tortilla has upped the tortilla game, too, because this year has been particularly difficult.
Oh, my Lord. It was a tortilla tournament of champions. We created it specifically so we could celebrate all the past winners in our tortilla tournament. And over the past couple of years, you've had people like, you know, smarting from their defeat a couple of years ago. So they have come back roaring with a vengeance. But then you have the old guard saying, like, you know, your Burritos La Palma and your home states of the world saying, you're not going to knock us off of our perch without a fight. And so the fighting on the tortilla plane has been incredibly ruthless and incredibly delicious.
Okay, so where are we? What's been happening with the corn bracket? What have you guys come down to?
Yeah, so in my bracket, I had as a final, you cannot think of two more different tortillas, not just in the make, but also in who makes them. You had Taco Maria, Michelin-starred restaurant by Carlos Salgado from Costa Mesa, a glorious blue corn tortilla that tastes of history because he's getting his masa straight from Mexico, his blue corn masa. He was up against Trader Joe's, and everyone loves Trader Joe's.
It just is so unlikely.
I know, but you could make fun of Trader Joe's, even though everyone secretly likes it. And their corn tortilla, I got to tell you, it has been extraordinary. It has an amazing corn flavor, as it should, because it only has three ingredients, corn, water, and lime. They have done a historic run through the Great Tortilla Tournament. But, you know, when you have an unstoppable force against the immovable object that is Taco Maria, the immovable object wins this time. So Taco Maria easily beat it because it's almost like night and day when it comes to what Taco Maria has versus everyone else. But now this is going to be a very interesting final because in Connie's bracket, she had Tallulah's from Santa Monica, which gets their corn, also blue corn from Hacienda, another organic non-GMO handmade corn tortilla. They were able to be La Princesita, which is a pioneering tortilla in East LA. I love their flour tortillas and their corn tortillas, but they also stood no chance. So now for the corn, you're going to have organic blue corn handmade versus organic blue corn handmade for the first time ever. And you want to talk about tough matchups? Wow, this one's going to be it.
I don't know if I'm looking forward to that or scared to death of it.
Someone has to win.
Yes, someone has to win. I know that. and I have to say that my matchup was just so hard. I mean, how do you make a choice between Sonora Town and Burritos La Palma?
Legends. Two flour tortilla legends. Sonora Town won our first tortilla tournament, our first golden tortilla. Burrito La Palma is a two-time finalist in the tortilla tournament. And also just, I mean, those are the tortillas that I like to get here in Santana. I don't know how to match them up, but you had to do it, Evan.
I had to do it, and it was a squeaker. And on the day, with those two tortillas that came out of the package, it was Burritos La Palma.
Wow. Wow. I mean, I cannot disagree with that. At the same time, Sonora Town makes one of the best flour tortillas in Southern California, but this is why you play the game, as that cliche goes in sports. Sometimes the Dodgers are going to lose. Sometimes they're going to win. And this year, Burrito La Palma, congrats.
Yeah, and I'm really excited for them because now they have the opportunity to vie for the crown. What about Mona's last matchup?
So Mona had a total surprise. I remember she actually waited a couple of days to tell me because I'm the one who has to notch everything. So she had what I thought was a no-brainer. Home State, the champion from last year, amazing Tex-Mex style tortillas, going up against Anchos. Anchos is like an El Torito clone in the Inland Empire in Riverside, but they happen to make these extraordinary small flour tortillas that puff up like balloons. And so does Home State. And I actually think the Home State tortilla is better than the Anchos tortilla. At the same time, saying Anchos makes extraordinary flour tortillas. So I told Mona, hey, Mona, like, so which is it? I need one more day. Okay, well, which is it? And then at the end, she's like, Anchos, I can't believe it myself. But when I found myself wanting a flour tortilla and which one did I keep going to? I kept going to Anchos. So a huge upset. First ever tortilla from the Inland Empire to be in the Fuerte Four. Knocked down Home State, which again makes an extraordinary flour tortilla. But at this point in the tournament, they're all extraordinary. But someone has to win.
That is just insane. How many people are going to be trekking out to Anchos now?
And they should. I mean, they absolutely should. And again, you go get your combo plates. They also have big, huge, and pretty good margaritas there. But you get these small little flour tortillas. You get a whole bunch of them and freeze them, and they're going to come out just fine. And I couldn't believe it. I mean, I remember we put them last year for the first time in our tortilla tournament, and they immediately went to the Suave 16. And I thought to myself, literally, the first time I drove to Anchos, because I had never been there before, and I thought, oh, boy. And you know this type of restaurant. It's like made up like an adobe. It's like a replica of Santa Fe. So you walk in thinking, oh, man, this is not going to work. And then you eat them. You immediately become a convert.
All right. Now it means that tomorrow it's actually happening. Tomorrow is the day we decide who gets the crown.
Yeah. October 10th. So Sunday from 11 to 4, we'll be there. We'll be judging. There's going to be an Ask a Tortilla Judge booth. We're going to have mariachis and all of our tortilla finals, our Fuerte Four finalists. They'll be making tortillas, but folks, please buy the tortillas off of them because, hey, we shouldn't be expecting any freebies in this day and age with restaurants.
And just a reminder that for the final, what we do is we have two rounds of judging. First, we complete the Fuerte Four. We make a decision on the best flour and the best corn. And then we take a break. And then we match up corn versus flour.
May the best tortilla win the golden tortilla.
That was Gustavo Arellano, namesake of Gustavo and KCRW's Great Tortilla Tournament of Champions. This has been a very exciting year with some surprising upsets, so the stakes are high. Come join me, Gustavo and our co-judges, KCRW's Connie Alvarez and Eater LA's Mona Holmes, as we determine who will take this year's golden tortilla. The event is free and open to the public. It's tomorrow, October 10th, from 11 to 4 at Smorgasburg, LA. You can RSVP and find all the details at kcrw.com/tortilla. I hope to see you there. Coming up, ready to test your boba IQ? LA's boba landscape is expansive, and my next guest is here with ideas for how to perfect your drink.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. There is a bit of ritual with boba. Slurping up tapioca pearls that are submerged in your choice of tea, either milky or flavored, through that wide straw. A concentration of boba shops in the San Gabriel Valley offer a range of flavors and special touches, including flakes of gold leaf and stir-fried boba balls. Christy Hang has a roundup of the best spots. Hi, Christy.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We're thrilled to have you back. It's so funny, when I was reading your latest boba roundup, about San Gabriel Valley spots for Eater, I realized that I know almost nothing about this beverage, how to order, what the choices are, and all the add-ins. I'm kind of in a blank state, and I assume there must be others out there. So let's consider this Boba 101, okay?
I'm more than happy to help you along.
Where is the birthplace of boba?
So boba actually came from Taiwan to the U.S. The first place was actually in the San Gabriel Valley in the mid-90s. And I remember getting it in the mid-90s. And at that point, the cheapest boba out there was 89 cents a cup. And now the most expensive boba is well over $10. So how times have changed. But, you know, it's so much more innovative now. You have your choice of affordable boba, really bougie, expensive boba. But, you know, you have so much choice in the San Gabriel Valley, but anywhere in LA, really. But we definitely have the best there is to offer in San Gabriel Valley. It's so innovative. And it's just amazing because this is the one industry that defies all logic, defies supply and demand. Anywhere else, you can't have the same type of business in a shopping plaza. If there's a P.F. Chang's in a mall, you can't have a Chinese restaurant too close to that, even though P.F. Chang's is considered Americanized Chinese food because the nature of competition. Those rules do not apply to boba. There is a boba intersection that I like to call it. In that intersection, there are four boba shops. Two of them are in the same plaza, and that just blows my mind.
So let's get really granular here, and let's start with the liquid that hosts the boba. So what is it, and then what can it be? Like, what's basic level, and how does it kind of get progressively more bougie, as you say?
If you want to be basic and you want to have your first boba, a lot of people have a smoothie, basically, and get the boba inside a smoothie. So you can even get like a piña colada type thing and have your smoothie and boba underneath there. And that's the tapioca balls. And then some people will have green tea, black tea, and that's kind of sort of what you start out with. So green tea, black tea, and then that's used also to make milk tea. So your choices are basically you get a fruit smoothie or you get a milk tea, or you get a green tea-based drink, like a passion fruit green tea or a passion fruit like black tea. So you can choose what types of fruit flavors you want, and then the bases are kind of those couple of bases that you play around with.
And when you say the words milk tea, do you just mean tea to which milk has been added?
Essentially, yes. But there are, let's say, the bougie places. So these places will actually have special machines where they brew really good tea. So they actually have tea leaves that are imported from China, that are imported from Taiwan, and each one of those teas are very, very different. So they actually have these really fancy names, and if you're a tea connoisseur, you can sit there all day and enjoy these different types of teas that are being mixed with your boba. But your run-of-the-mill boba place just has a very average kind of green tea. I would kind of say it's kind of like going to a dim sum place, and the first thing they ask you is, what kind of tea do you want? And they give you like five types of tea they can choose from. It's a very basic tea. You're not going to get anything too amazing or grandiose, but it does the job. It's kind of like, I guess, going to Starbucks.
So if we're at a starter level, what is a place that you can suggest to us to go to, and what should we order there?
You know what? I think half and half, or half and half good old time. And they're slightly different, but from the same family. And it's very run-of-the-mill, very easy to understand. So you're not having amazing boba per se, but it's very nostalgic. If you guys were around during the 90s, this is the first type of boba that was brought over. So it's the essential chain store. So you go and you say, okay, am I in the mood for kind of something sweet? Just basically an iced tea. So I would probably order a passion fruit green tea. Or if I'm in the mood for a milk tea, I would get a plain milk tea. And then you can choose to have boba, or there's also other toppings as well. So you can get like little coconut bits on the bottom. You can get little jelly bits on the bottom. If you want to get fancy, there's this thing called grass jelly, which is kind of like an herbal jelly that is kind of like medicinal tasting, but it's really good for you. And a lot of people really like it.
Talk to me about cheese foam.
Cheese foam. Oh, it sounds so So gross, right? But cheese foam came from Taiwan, and it's so good. It's topping. It's essentially having creme brulee on top, right? And it's delicious. There's places like Xin Fu Tang in Roland Heights, and they're really known for their cheese foam. And they actually pull out the machine and kind of torch on top for you as they're making your boba. It's quite the experience. And so I guess the best way to explain is just don't think of it as cheese foam, because that sounds a little bit jarring. Think of it as a creme brulee topping. And I think that really helps people open up their minds and try something different.
So the cheese is actually like a creme fraiche or something like that?
Basically, yeah.
Wow. Okay, that changes. That changes it. Totally.
It's bad marketing. They shouldn't have called it cheese foam.
And now I understand that there are many places that make their own boba throughout the day and keep them warm. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so I mean, with so much competition, especially in the San Gabriel Valley, a lot of places have started to make their own boba. And it's crazy to see them bring out the tapioca starch. And it's almost like going to a mall and seeing them make the pretzels in front of you. It's the same thing. You see them with the dough, and there's someone there kneading this dough, putting the different flavors into it, and running it through the machine. So you actually see each little tapioca pearl come down. And then you'll see them stir-frying it on the pan to give it the caramel flavor. The difference is when a lot of places don't do the so-called stir fry in the pot with the caramel and brown sugar, that you kind of just taste the boba. And boba itself doesn't really have a taste. So when it's made hot and kept warm over this pan or this kind of wok, it ensures that the brown sugar and the caramel flavor is absorbed into the boba.
Okay, so just as many people who go to Starbucks have an intricate order, what is your go-to order? Tell me the place you go to and what your go-to order would be.
I mean, I am really loving Sunrite Tea Studio. They have been opening not just in San Gabriel Valley, but all over, even in NorCal, and I think they just opened one in Little Tokyo. They're all over. And my go-to order is their creme brulee Oreo. And I don't even like Oreo, but it's so good. So I have to get that. I get it with no ice, so it doesn't dilute your drink if you take it home to drink it. And also you get more liquid. So get it with no ice. And then I get it 75% sugar. And then I make sure boba is inside there too. And if I'm feeling a little exciting and I want to add other toppings inside, you can add extra red bean. You can add extra mochi inside. They can add grass jelly. They have a bunch of toppings. And then I just make sure it's not completely sweet. 75% sugar is all I need. And that's my perfect order.
Okay, so what does 75% sugar mean? It doesn't mean that 75% of the drink is made with sugar.
Oh, yeah. So that is definitely difficult to gauge. So when you go to any boba spot, usually, I'm going to say 99% of them, because there is one place that won't let you do that. But they will ask you, how sweet do you want it? And if they don't ask you, they're just assuming that it's going to be 100% sweet, what their normal is. And for me, since I like to get my drinks with either less ice or no ice at all, I like to adjust the sweetness. So I just say, usually they might just say, oh, so no sugar, 25% sugar, 50% sugar, 75. And I just say 75 or 50, so I just don't want it too sweet, so they'll adjust it. But it's hard to tell what someone's 75% is, so you just kind of go a few times, or they can always remake your drink for you. So it gets a little complicated when you order. It's kind of like those Starbucks hacks where you're like, I want only this, this, and this, but add a pump of this and take a pump of that out and put this topping on. It's very, the orders can get a little bit crazy.
Okay, we have time for one more. Something on the bougie end, maybe a spot that's known for the quality of its tea.
Sure. I also really like Gin Tea. I think they have two locations. One might be in NorCal, but their location locally is actually in Pasadena. And I mean, their tea is just amazing. If I drink their milk tea past 3 o'clock, maybe it's just showing my age, but I'm awake for the rest of the night. So you know they're not skipping out on the caffeine aspect of it. But I like to get their Oriental Beauty milk tea. And it's just one of those fancy names for the type of tea that they use. It's imported straight from Taiwan. And I also get that less sugar and no ice in that. And those boba pearls melt in your mouth. It's it's so al dente. Taiwanese people like to use the term QQ to describe it, and it's just the perfect snap when you bite into their boba balls, and it's brown sugary goodness. It's excellent.
Wow. This has been so much fun. Thank you, Christy.
Thank you.
Christy Hang is a journalist covering food and Chinese culture. She wrote The Ultimate Guide to Boba in the SGV for Eater LA. We've got a link on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. Chefs No Repla and Fern Gautatip met when they were kids on the island of Phuket in southern Thailand. As adults, they each moved to Los Angeles, exploring the city and its food scene before they partnered to open Love to Eat Thai Bistro in 2014. Almost immediately, they developed a following for their fiery crab curry and warm hospitality, and another restaurant followed, No Re Thai on Beverly. Fern and Nori are here to speak about their shared passion in this week's In the Weeds.
My name is Fern Somruthai Gautatip. I'm the owner of Love to Eat Thai Bistro, and we are the chef.
My name is Nori, or Chef La. Yeah, I'm the owner of Love to Eat and Nori Thai on Beverly. Every day I cook, and then I make the secret recipe, and every night go to the restaurant for Nori Thai and Love to Eat. Me and Fern always go to the restaurant and take care of the customer. Yeah, when I was young, we studied at the same primary school and have the same friend too. In Patong Beach, Fern, Chef Fern, she in the Phuket town.
You know, Phuket is the island, and we almost know, like, almost every family. It's a mix of culture, so Phuket food is kind of my, like, number one that I'm familiar with. For Thai food, you can find anywhere Pad Thai, you know, in every part of Thailand. But in Phuket, you have some certain dish that you can find only in Phuket.
When I was young, I loved to eat seafood because I live in Patong Beach. Every day is gonna have the small boat come from the sea every day, and I sell the fresh fish, fresh crab, fresh squid. Something like that. My mom always buy that one and make the crab curry in the small pot. I love that very much.
I was always in the kitchen with my grandma, and I try to help her cooking, like I'm being her pep cook. And yeah, it was like my inspiration to work in the kitchen. But then I went to university, and I continue my bachelor degree in marketing, and I work for like petroleum company for a few years, and then my dad said, "Hey, you should go for master degree or something like that." But once I get here in US, I changed from master degree to culinary school in Pasadena. So yeah, that's why. That's the how I become to be a chef.
I start interesting about cooking because my dad and my mom is a chef. Always we cook together in the kitchen at in the evening, and my mom opened the restaurant in Patong Beach, not far from the beach.
We want to come here together, but I came first, and then she followed me. We have same passion, you know, about cooking. We want to cook some southern dish Thai food that we have, like our recipe. We just want to let people know more about Thai food, we just decided that we should open our own restaurant in 2014. Before that, I was a cook. I was a light cook at Polo Laos at the Beverly Hills Hotel. And Pa was a waitress at one Thai restaurant. Once I finished my culinary school, we think it might be a good time that we should open our own instead of being partner with someone else.
Yeah, before I thinking, oh, what I want to cook, I thinking about my mom crab curry. Yeah, because in here, I didn't see crab curry in another restaurant. And I think, oh, this one is very good. And it's use the fresh crab and coconut milk and have the chili paste homemade. That one is made from the turmeric. That one is very good. That one, my first dish that I want to cook here when I open the restaurant.
COVID changed everything. Once they announced that we have to close for dine-in, we try to think a lot. What should we do? Because it's gonna change everything. For me, I think like, how can I cut the cost? How can I control the cost? How can we make all of us to survive? And we are so lucky. We have really lovely customer who always supporting us and helping us. Like the first few day that we closing dine, people came and supporting us. I never expect that we're gonna have like this kind of problem before. Right now it's getting better since they let us open for dine-in. I mean, it's not like before, but it's getting much better than like pandemic last year, you know.
If to go to Love to Eat, if you want to try the signature food, crab curry is very good because it's my secret recipe that my mom teach me how to make. And Hat Yai fried chicken is very, very good.
If someone allergic to crab, you can try with fish curry. It's the same base that Chef Ba make. And then my dish that I want to suggest is Hat Yai fried chicken. It's a southern style of fried chicken. It comes with sticky rice and spicy sweet chili sauce with a lot of fried shallot on top. And another dish that very famous at our restaurant is called mu ping. Mu ping is like pork skewer. We marinate it overnight and then we grill it. And yeah, it's tastes very yummy, this one. I love it.
Chefs No Repla and Fern Gautatip are the duo behind Love to Eat Thai Bistro and No Re Thai on Beverly. Many thanks to Nisha Venkat, who produced this week's edition of In the Weeds. In a minute, a restaurateur looks back at his career in the restaurant business and reflects on how it's been transformed. He has one solution for the broken industry, and dear listener, it involves you. Stay with us. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Restaurants will never be the same. They shouldn't be. That was the headline of a widely shared New York Times op-ed by longtime restaurateur and colleague Peter Hoffman. In it, he stated with great eloquence that restaurants are broken, and it's up to the diners as much as the restaurateurs to fix them. Between 1990 and 2016, Peter operated three restaurants in New York City, Savoy, Back 40, and Back 40 West. Since he closed the restaurants, he's had a chance to reflect on what changed and what needs desperately to change more. I spoke to Peter recently after the publication of his memoir, What's Good? A Memoir in 14 Ingredients. Hi, Peter.
Hey, Evan.
It's great to talk to you. It's been so long.
I know. I'm so glad to be connected to you here today.
When did you realize that you wanted to cook as a job?
Well, you know, it started with this photograph of Paul Bocuse that was on the cover of the New York Times Magazine section in the 70s, mid-70s. And here was this grand, proud man in a farmer's market surveying the bounty and the beauty of the market. And I looked at it and I said, that's it. This is creative, artistic, intellectually stimulating. It's going to be everything that I want it to be in a career. And so then I started to pursue it. And the first thing I did in certain ways was I moved up to Stowe, Vermont, and got myself a job in a restaurant. It was not a good restaurant, but I was in a ski town and learned what the world of restaurants was all about.
The restaurant that most people know you from and the one that was your primary passion for years was Savoy. But
right.
Describe the restaurant that came before Savoy and the one that came after. You talk about how bookends sometimes shed light on what was between them.
Yeah. I didn't realize it until the book opens where, and it really is a true moment of realization. I'm standing on the corner opposite the building, and I've sold the lease and I've gotten out and I've sold it to a fast casual business chain, food chain. And I realized that on one side prior to me was a restaurant that was a luncheonette. It was pretty much a hot food on a cafeteria line, although people didn't, I mean, you still ordered, but it was dish out, a little bit of griddle, cooking for the workers, mostly textile workers in loft spaces in Soho. And so that was on one end. The other bookend was this fast casual restaurant that bought the lease from me for a new set of neighborhood workers, which were internet and design and tech and things like that. And I realized that it really was a very unique period of time in between that 25 years that I was there running a fine dining restaurant, not a super high-end restaurant by any means, but one that was about the pleasures of the table, the pleasures of company, and the delight that food and wine can provide in a humane setting, you know, not a feeding trough, but rather a way to dine. And I realized that that window opened and then that window closed because of how the economics of the neighborhood had changed over time.
So much of what you write about in this memoir, for me, has taken on even more nuanced meaning by what the restaurant business has gone through over the past 18 months.
Yes, indeed.
And the lack of literal face-to-face hospitality. You speak about this idea of regulars and what regulars bring to a neighborhood restaurant and the community that was built by the type of restaurant that the Savoy was.
Well, you know, one of the things I say in the book is that I never was, I mean, we used the word regular because it was useful, shorthand. The other that would go in the reservation book was FOPH, friend of Peter Hoffman. And maybe that gets more to the point than a regular, because it wasn't a unidirectional transactional relationship in which they come in and give me money and I feed them and they come, whoever that regular is, comes in once a week or once a month or whatever that periodicity is that makes somebody a regular customer. But rather that it went in both directions, that we, not just me, but we, the community of people working in that house, took something, gained something from those people as well. Sometimes it was book recommendations or observations and thoughts, ways that they gave to us or told us about what their work was, their lives, and that made us richer individuals as members of this community. I had this dinner series that I ran that was not the traditional, oh, we're doing the food and wine of Tuscany kind of thing, but they were more theoretical. Some of them were about food, some of them were about New York City history or poetry, things like that. And many of the guest speakers were customers that I had conversations with, and it grew out that when I realized who they were and what their interests were, I invited them to come speak over a communally plated dinner where we all sat at large tables together and ate at the same time, and we talked about ideas. And so the restaurant became a community center in many respects, and so that people used it in a way to, again, not just be fed with calories, but be fed with ideas.
Given what we've watched happen in the restaurant business in the last period of time, and this period that you've been working on this memoir and thinking back and thinking about your life in restaurants, I'd love to know thoughts that you've had about the business now, and sort of like, if you were to talk to a young person who is thrilled to get into it now, what like, not necessarily advice would you give, but what thoughts would you ask them to keep in their minds?
Great question. It's such a complicated moment. Even before the pandemic, I think what we saw in around the country and in New York City in particular is that the equation was no longer working. The equation being, what are the costs? That is the cost of food and the cost of labor and rent and all the other particulars, and what people are willing to pay. And so those questions have been on our minds and bubbling up, whether that's about tips and what do we do about the tip situation and the disparity of income coming into the restaurant that we may or may not have control of, either as owners or as a community, in terms of, you know, it's at the whim of somebody who's at the table, how they're feeling about their experience, and other equity issues in terms of how, you know, it's a low-paying business. People are always cutting margins. And so the race to the bottom, whether that's to buy the cheapest ingredients that you can so that you can make the most profit, but then it's food that's destructive of the environment. And then for me as a chef and owner saying, I'm not participating in that part of it. I'm going to thrive as an owner by not being part of that race to the bottom. And the same thing applies to salaries for employees. And it was very, very difficult. And, you know, I had this distinct memory of deep discouragement when I walked through the kitchen, knowing the finances were getting difficult. And I looked in the eyes of a man who had been very devoted cook for me, father of a couple of kids, knowing that there was no way I was ever going to be able to afford to pay his health care for him. And that felt so wrong. And the helplessness that I felt around that as an owner with the amount of money slash profit that was coming into the restaurant at that time. So the equation wasn't working. The pandemic laid that out even more clearly to us through the entire food system. I think the equation really has to change. And in some ways, fundamentally, people, diners, have to start to really get used to paying more for dinner. When we buy cheap food, there have been costs that were externalized, that were taken out of the cost of that ingredient because you were allowed to dump sludge in a river, and so the cleanup was passed on to taxpayers, or it's passed on to future generations, or it's part of the destruction of the planet. Those externalized costs we came to understand as chefs and buyers, and folded that into our operation and explained to our customers, to our diners, what they were paying for and why they were paying for it. And my customers, part of what made the whole experience so wonderful is they knew that that's why they were there, and they said that's why they were there. And, you know, it's one thing to say, I'm my home, I cook for two people, I'm going to buy right. But when the entire community supported my buying in millions of dollars per year of product, that set the stage for a more fundamental level of change. So where does that bring us now is to say that if we don't no longer externalize the cost of a decent wage, that everybody should be able to call out sick, that the structure of the restaurant should have enough flexibility in it that there isn't just one person who can make pastry, and so that they come in on their day off and potentially infect everybody else. We learned that from the pandemic, that we had to take care of our community, whether it was the community within the restaurant or the community at large.
Yeah, I think this idea of drawing a line between becoming educated about the real cost of food absolutely needs to be linked to paying the real cost of human labor. And,
right.
And I thank you for drawing that line.
Yeah, yeah. I've been thinking a lot about it, Evan, and I think it's the link that will help people get over the place where they're resistant to what the new menu prices are going to have to be. Instead of going like, can you believe what they're charging? You know, it's just like, it's outrageous. Well, okay, cook at home. It's, you know, if you don't want to pay that, if you don't want to outsource your cooking, please cook at home. You know, it's a great experience to cook your own food and please yourself, and it costs a whole lot less money. But if you're going to outsource it because you don't want to do it, or you want a broader, different kind of experience, now we're going to look at what the real price of that is.
Thank you, Peter. Your book is such a deep examination of a period of time that I think is important to look at as we go forward.
Thanks. Wonderful to have this conversation with you today, Evan.
That was chef restaurateur Peter Hoffman. His memoir is What's Good? A memoir in 14 ingredients. Part of what made Peter's restaurant so compelling was his commitment to the farmers. And of course, here at Good Food, we wholeheartedly agree that farmers are an intrinsic part of our food community, and how fantastic it is that we get to hear from them each week on the show. Jillian Ferguson is at the Santa Monica Market now with news of what's in season this week in Southern California.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. I'm at the market this morning with Sasha Paligian of May Micro Bakery. Sasha is part of what I would call the micro bakery movement in Los Angeles, where former restaurant pastry chefs have gone out on their own and created cottage businesses. And she's become well known for her beautiful layer cakes made with seasonal produce. Hi, Sasha.
Hi, thank you for having me.
My pleasure. So just to give people a sense of the creativity and the seasonality that you bring to your menu, can you just give us a rundown of the fall cakes that you have on your menu right now?
Yeah, so the fall cakes I have right now are a carrot, coriander, and turmeric cake, passion fruit, vanilla, white chocolate, and chocolate, rye, olive oil, date, and tahini.
So the date cake particularly caught my eye because this time of year we're like at the tail end of the fresh barhi date harvest, and then you've got all the other date varieties that we get to choose from as well. Can you just walk us through the different components of that cake and how you incorporate the dates?
Yeah, so the cake base is chocolate olive oil, so it's like a super rich fudgy cake. And then in the middle, I do a brown sugar pastry cream, so it's like reinforcing the caramel flavor of the dates. So it's like a little salty brown sugar pastry cream, and then the halawi dates get folded into the cream. The texture is there a little bit, but the caramely flavor, you can taste it and you get a little bit of chew. And then like the tahini buttercream, it's like the savory note for the cake. So it's not just like rich sugar caramely. The tahini sort of rounds everything out.
And talk about why you chose the halawi date. Is it that caramel flavor you're looking for?
Yeah, the halawi date is just, it like melts in your mouth, super caramelly. I know it's sweet, but I don't find it to be overly sweet. And I just like the depth of flavor in the caramel.
Something I always struggle with at home when I'm chopping up dates is that they're so sticky. They stick to my knife. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, so I'm not really chopping them up. I'm mostly just like pulling the seed out and leaving like the two halves. So I'm not, if you chop them up too much, they just kind of melt, right? So I'm just pulling the seed out and then leaving the halves in, and I'm folding that into the cream.
So is the end result like a little bit of texture in that pastry cream?
Yeah, it's a little bit of texture. You know, it melts a little bit, but there's still some chew.
And talk a little bit about your creative process for a cake like this. Do you start with the idea of using dates and then work backwards from there? How do you come up with these?
I think I started this cake with tahini, and then I thought about dates. And the chocolate cake flavor is sort of like a base flavor that I have on my menu for the chocolate lovers. And then I'm just trying to think of different flavors to use in the different seasons. And I feel like chocolate is always hard for me just because I don't necessarily tend towards chocolate and fruit. But this seemed like a really good pair. The process, it's not as like glamorous as you think, you know? It's just like it's an idea. And then I'll go to the market and I'll be like, oh, dates. That's what will go with the tahini.
Yeah, we are getting into fall produce here. Is there anything else at the market that you're looking towards right now and getting excited about?
Citrus, any kind of citrus. If you know me, you know I'm a citrus freak. Like I just put a Bear's Lime pie on my menu. I am like waiting for blood oranges, waiting for all the citrus. I know we're like a bit a ways away, but I'm here for it.
Yeah. We all are, absolutely. Okay, well, thank you so much, Sasha.
Thank you.
That was Sasha Paligian, pastry chef and owner behind May Micro Bakery out in Glendale. You can follow her on Instagram at sashimi1, that's sashimi with the number one after it, or just search for May Micro Bakery online. Alvaro Bautista of Bautista Family Organic Dates is one of the farmers who brings dates to the market here in Santa Monica. And Alvaro, we are at the tail end of the Barhi date season, which is the seasonal dates that everybody looks forward to. They come to the market fresh, hard, and yellow at the beginning of the season, and then slowly, slowly they start to ripen. Do you have any of those Barhi dates left?
Not in the yellow stage, but we carry them like liquid right now. They're like super ripe, and I call them like liquid gold because they are yellowish liquid, and I mean those you only have to chew them, they just melt in your mouth.
Yes, you just gave me one, and it's true, they do melt right in your mouth. So tell us a little bit about the season of dates. You know, you come in late August with those fresh barhis. Where are we now in date season?
We're kind of finished already the harvest. We've got another week to go. We're still harvesting deglets, sahidis, which are a little drier, but the kadrawis, the halawis, the caramel ones, they're all harvest. So we'll carry them all the way, hopefully all the way till May. We always finish maybe two months before the new season comes in. So we're going to be having, juicy dates till May, hopefully.
Wow. So when you're harvesting, not the barhis, which we know we can eat fresh, but those kadrawis, the halawis, are you also harvesting those when they are hard like that and then you have to wait for them to soften?
The only ones you are edible, they are edible, but the ones that taste really beautiful are the barhis. Those are the ones that are edible, like crunchy, the crunchy state or the liquid stage. But the other ones, the halawis, they have to be ripened on the tree. Kadrawis, they have, because they have a little
astringency.
Yes.
Yeah.
But once they ripen on the tree, they're super amazing. And we always, every season, we're trying to get them the juiciest possible, like harvest them right in their prime.
And to harvest them, do you have to climb all the way up in the trees?
Yeah, we have to climb, but we also, like 15 years ago, we planted a few more trees. So our trees are 10 footers, 20 footers, but the oldest ones, yeah, they're 60 footers. And we have to harvest them not one by one, but we put a basket under the bunch, and whatever comes off, it's already ripe. And then we have to go up again in a couple of weeks or so.
Oh, okay, so it's a process. It's not like you're harvesting one spray at a time.
No, that's why we try to get them under prime. We don't want to wait till the end because they'll get like too dry if we wait till the end. And so you want to go ahead and harvest like one or two times each tree.
Once you harvest them, do you have to dry them further or do they just go straight into storage?
Well, they do go straight to storage because once you harvest them, they have to be refrigerated. If not, they will ferment. And sometimes I say they could probably turn to wine, which I have not tried it, but they're so liquidy and they probably do turn to wine, but not mine. I don't let them go bad.
Okay, so when we come here to the market, we should take them home and put them in our fridge immediately.
Yes, please, because it has happened that some customers don't refrigerate them, and they do turn to, and they kind of spoiled, but I don't know if they're bad, but they taste a little licorice.
Okay, well, we're so happy to have you back. Thanks for all the great info.
Thank you so much for everything.
That was Alvaro Bautista of Bautista Family Organic Dates. He brings his dates from Mecca in the Coachella Valley every Wednesday to the Santa Monica Farmers Market and Sunday to the Hollywood Farmers Market. For anyone still looking for those crunchy, fresh Barhi dates, Flying Disc Ranch will be back in Santa Monica this coming Wednesday, and they have quite a crop left. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
When Good Food returns, Lebanese mujadra, Eritrean lamb shanks, Venezuelan arepas, and Guatemalan goat. Flavors from Afar features the food of refugees and asylum seekers. Bill Addison has their story next. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. The great thing about LA is you don't have to go far to taste flavors from afar. Los Angeles Times restaurant critic Bill Addison explains how. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Evan. I miss seeing your face in the studio.
I'm actually in the studio today.
Jealous.
It's my first time back.
Wow, welcome back.
So Flavors from Afar, an interesting restaurant. Tell us about it.
The restaurant opened in Little Ethiopia in March 2020, an exceptionally daunting time, obviously, to open any sort of business. But in a lot of ways, it feels right on time. The structure of this restaurant is unique and rewardingly daunting. It's an extension of an organization called the TIA Foundation, founded by Maimouna Hussein Katan. The mission of the organization is to assist families of refugees, immigrants, and displaced indigenous communities through various services, including educational support, mentoring, and workshops. Flavors from Afar is an arm of that organization. And what they do, as co-founder Christian Davis described to me, is we highlight cooks and chefs who are refugees, asylum seekers, and immigrants making cuisines from around the world. So that translates into a different menu every month from a different cook who works with Flavors from Afar's in-house chefs. It's a program led by instructor and chef Kenna Copes. So they have, in the past year and a half, highlighted Guatemalan cuisine, Palestinian cuisine, Kenyan, Venezuelan, Somali cuisine. I first heard about it when Esther Tseng, one of my favorite LA food writers, wrote about it for Food 52 last year, but it popped up again on my radar when I was recently writing about Mamalina Cooks, a takeout business that serves the cooks Lebanese food. And being the fan of Lebanese food that I am, I noticed on Flavors from Afar's Instagram account, they were like, something's coming, it's Lebanese food. And then I was like, I wonder who it is. And it turned out to be Lena George, who is the chef behind Mamalina Cooks. So I went over for the first time and had so much delicious food, beautiful salads, like the Arabic salad, like the fattoush, lamb dishes, shawarma. It was interesting because the cooks themselves are not cooking the food. They come in and train the in-house chefs to make their food. So it's interesting to see kind of how the transition is made. And I thought they did a really good job with Lena George's food.
Yeah, that's fascinating that you got to have like two visions of the same food.
While writing about them at the same time, that's not happened in my near 20-year career.
Yeah.
It was odd and interesting.
Really interesting. And I noticed when I was looking at their menu that they also have this daily menu that's unbelievably eclectic, that involves Somali dishes.
Yes, including the sambusas that are delicious with cheese and potato.
Yeah, and some Mexican dishes, like there's flautas on the menu.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that as they have worked with cooks and perfected some dishes, they're keeping some fan favorites and some in-house favorites as they go along, kind of creating a daily menu, which is a lot of work and really cool. It's not like any other restaurant in Los Angeles. I'm really into it. It's now October, and the cuisine for this month is Chechen. They are not identifying the chef. They're calling her Chef E. They're not revealing her identity because she and her family are still in the process of seeking asylum from Chechnya. But they are serving dishes from her that include Manti, those beautiful, delicate handmade dumplings that stretch over many cultures in that part of the world, and a dish called Chebrek. It's almost like a similar to a quesadilla, like a pan-fried flatbread with spiced beef that you fold over and grill. And also a cool spin on goulash, the spiced stew that's vegetarian with Brussels sprouts and potatoes, kind of right on time for the changing weather in Los Angeles.
Wow, that sounds like something wonderful to look forward to. Thank you so much for this, Bill.
Thank you, Evan.
That was Bill Addison, the LA Times restaurant critic, talking about flavors from afar. To find his recommendations across the city and what to order, visit our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks always go out to the Good Food team. They are Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, and Desmond Taylor. Special thanks to Nisha Venkat, Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, Kenny Ng, Gary Masiha, and Nick Lamponi. I'm Evan Kleiman. Treat yourself to a boba this weekend. I'll be back next week with another episode of Good Food.